Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Monday morning, July 13th. Currently 71 degrees here in Old Town Park City under partly cloudy, partly smoky skies. Heber City reporting 70 degrees at the city airport. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. I tell you what, it was definitely a hot weekend across the Wasatch Back and most of the state of Utah, with many locations setting new all-time record high temperatures. Well, it's still going to be a hot day today, but just not as hot as our Sunday as we go throughout our Monday. So look for mostly sunny skies out there. We'll see temperatures climbing into the mid-90s for us in Park City this afternoon. We'll see those high temperatures returning to the triple digits in the Heber Valley. We start to see some changes, though, developing. We'll have some extra cloud cover sneaking in as we go throughout today along the Heber Valley. By the time we get into your Tuesday, we're going to be introducing a chance of some of those isolated showers and thunderstorms popping up, and we'll see that off and on chance of daily pop-up showers and storms really from Tuesday all the way through the weekend and beyond. And that's because we're going to be seeing somewhat of a monsoon pattern developing. Of course, this is monsoon season. That should allow for some of that moisture stream in from the south, and that should overall give us these daily chances of pop-up showers and storms. Now, not everyone's going to see thunderstorms every day, but I do think at some point in time during the week, each of us will hopefully get some beneficial moisture to put into the ground. What this will do is it will bring in at least a little moisture into the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere, and that should actually help us out a little bit in terms of lowering the fire danger threat, at least the widespread threat, as we get a little bit more humidity in the moisture in the air, and hopefully help lower some of those winds a little bit. But we'll keep an eye on that. But either way, daily pop-up chances of showers and thunderstorms for us this week after we get into your Tuesday and beyond, and will help to hold those temperatures down a little bit. So highs go from the mid-90s in Park City on your Monday afternoon to low 90s on your Tuesday to only in the 80s as we get towards your Wednesday into the weekend. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley, well, temperatures in the triple digits one more time for today. Then I think it's just upper 90s for your Tuesday afternoon. But guess what? The rest of the week, how about highs only in the low to mid 90s? That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with Summit County Health Department Director Phil Bondurant. Later on, Summit County Sheriff Casey Bates and Chief Deputy John Evans with an update on some law enforcement issues. And finally, Park City Opera's Lena Goldstein and Rachel Kubernick discuss their upcoming roles in the Tenderland production happening this weekend. Taking a look now at some local news, Summit County is drafting guidelines for data centers on its rural east side. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports planners want to protect open space from industrial campuses.
Local leaders from Summit County attended a statewide conference in June regarding data center regulation. KUBR reports that most of Utah's local laws are silent on the large computing campuses that have proven controversial around the country. But Summit County's in a good position to put new rules on the books, planners say, since it's in the middle of revising both the Snyderville Basin and Eastside general plans. Principal Planner Ray Milliner says staff have added data centers into the draft Eastern Summit County general plan. Planning commissioners may vote on it later this year.
Probably bolster that up in the general plan some more and then think about doing some code amendments.
General plans are usually advisory, but they guide county code, which is legally binding. A draft of the general plan chapter on open space addresses community concerns related to data center, says a county staff report. Draft policy 7.11 would, quote, discourage large-scale industrial or utility-intensive land uses in areas identified for open space preservation, end quote, including in agricultural lands. Commissioner David Darcy attended the Utah Association of Counties' June 24th conference on data center regulations. He says he was surprised by how many counties would welcome those developments.
If there's a lot of counties in the state that want these things, which tells me that coming to us for one and having to go through the gauntlet of Summit County as opposed to somebody that wants one probably would deter a lot of people, but you never know.
Land in Summit County is expensive too, but Darcy says that's not a deterrent.
The project developers did confirm that land cost is so insignificant compared to the rest of the personal property, the computers and the power generation costs. Land is not that big of a cost. even though they are putting them out in some pretty rural areas of Iron County or Box Elder County.
Darcy is a former market researcher for a natural gas pipeline provider and has previously said that Summit County, like Box Elder, has that kind of infrastructure. Using it to power data centers might bring construction jobs to Summit County. But Darcy says developers at UAC's conference didn't give a definitive answer about how many long-term jobs those campuses actually create. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Summit County Health Department, I have Director Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So West Nile virus, actually I wanted to talk to you a little bit because I know that you're coming from the Heber Valley. What's it like over there? Because we got a little bit of smoke in the sky here with that outbreak of a fire there.
Yeah, it's hot, and we're definitely in the throngs of summer. But I felt that this morning and then yesterday there was a little bit of haze coming out of the fire there in Wasatch County, and I think we should anticipate here in Summit County seeing some of that perimeter smoke leak in with some of those prevailing winds, and anticipate that might be the case moving forward as fires pop up. And we encourage those that are have respiratory illness or underlying health conditions that make you sensitive to smoke to be very careful when you're out and about. You know, choose your times to exercise or be outdoors carefully. Our website has a really robust network of air monitoring equipment where you can see the PM2.5 counts. The state does a wonderful job of keeping that information readily available as well. So, you know, do what we can to limit our time outdoors, even for the healthy population. Smoke can really wreak havoc on your lungs. So unfortunately, when we're in the West in a drought in a year like this, we should anticipate we're going to have to deal a little bit with smoke.
Yeah, the conditions in the valley, Heber Valley, are much worse, I'm guessing, than here.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I didn't check the air monitors this morning, but just from an anecdotal visual assessment, I think that Heber Valley is definitely experiencing a little bit of smoke, and we can anticipate that later on in the day here.
Okay. And West Nile virus, as I started to say, has made its debut in Utah. Talk to us a little bit about what this is and what Summit County residents need to know about it.
Yeah, West Nile virus is not new. It's been around for a while. In fact, that's where I started my public health career, was doing zoonotic disease surveillance in Clark County, Nevada, where West Nile virus was the hot topic then. So it's been roughly 20 plus years we've dealt with West Nile virus, which is a mosquito-borne disease, meaning that you can only contract it by being bitten with an infected mosquito. It's not a human-to-human transmission. And in most cases, about 80% of the cases, there are no symptoms, or the symptoms are very mild, traditional flu-like symptoms, chills, headache, discomfort. But on occasion, it does progress into encephalitis, which is much more serious. It can be high fevers, really strong headaches, neck stiffness, dysentery orientation, tremor, seizures. It's not a good thing. And so we are encouraging people, with it being a little bit earlier in the season, that North Salt Lake, Davis County area traditionally has positive mosquitoes, as you might expect coming off the Great Salt Lake. But it is early this season. It's also early in neighboring states to see West Nile virus this time of year. And we could possibly attribute that to the drought. But we want folks to know it's here, it's in the state, and whether you're in Summit County or somewhere else, always take precautions. Wear DEET, other types of insect repellent, long sleeve clothes, and just take care of yourself. If you don't get bit, you won't get West Nile virus, but it is important around this time of year as we move into later part of July and August that we're reminded that mosquitoes do carry disease. We have disease in mosquitoes in Utah, and just making people aware.
All right. Encephalitis is brain related?
It is. It's swelling of the brain and the spinal cord.
Yeah, and it is a particular mosquito, as I recall, that only that type of mosquito gets infected with West Nile, that can infect people. And it seems like this was back way when we may not have that type of mosquito at this elevation.
Yeah, the main vector for West Nile virus is Culex tarsalis mosquito. It is an aggressive biter in the mornings and the evenings, and it's a fairly invasive mosquito, meaning I think it can be found year round. The reason we don't see West Nile virus until later in the year is that there are a number of environmental conditions that must be present in order for the virus to proliferate inside of the mosquito. And we just haven't had it be warm enough long enough yet. Now, we say that, we just talked about the heat a little bit ago and it is warming up. But I do believe that Culex tarsalis is present in Summit County. It's definitely present in Wasatch County and the greater parts of the Salt Lake Valley. So wherever you're at, you know, mosquitoes are there. They carry disease. They're a nuisance. They're miserable. So do what you can to protect yourself and your little ones.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about rabies prevention. You know, and this is so interesting because I had heard a story of a bat that was flying out during the day, and my first response was, oh my gosh, that bat was rabid. And apparently it turned out to be rabid. You know, they wouldn't caught it. But tell me, have we had any instances of rabies here in the, Summit County?
I'm not aware of any current cases of rabies in bats or other animals, but we should treat bats, all bats, as if they do have rabies. Most of the cases that we see in animals in the state of Utah come from bats. And sometimes, you know, whether we're staying in a cabin or we're out and about, we just can't avoid bats. And anytime we come into contact, we want to be very careful that if a person did have contact with a bat, we take the utmost precautions, because rabies is a very fatal, it's nearly 100% fatal disease. And so if you come into contact with a bat or a raccoon or a wild animal that is, it's not acting normal, we ask you that you try to capture it, because it can be tested. And if we can confirm inside of that animal that it is not rabid, you won't have to go through the prophylaxis and you know, take care of that. But in the instance when, you know, you can't capture the bat or the raccoon or whatever, then we have to take those precautions, and it's not a fun experience for individuals.
Yeah, it's a series of many.
It's a series of many painful shots. It can be very pricey, and so it's best to handle all of those type of animals with the utmost care. If you do wake up in a cabin or a room and there's a bat in your room, knock it down with a broom, get a heavy pair of leather gloves or a towel or something. Don't smash it. Our natural reaction is we just want to smash it and take care of it, but we need that brain intact and in good condition so the state lab can test it. Our staff is, we have protocols and SOPs in place that when that happens, we can collect the sample, we can get it down to the state lab in a really quick time frame so that we can get those results back to the families as soon as possible so that we can take the right actions.
So how do bats get rabies?
From other bats. It's one of those things where the way they colonize and the way that they go about their business, they tend to contract it through the saliva of other bats and scratches the same way that we do. So if you find a bat, and this tends to be the case with most children, they see a bat, it's cool, it's something they learn about in school. It's not something you see every day, especially out in the middle of the day. And our first instinct is it's dead, let's pick it up. And that might not be the case. And so even the slightest scratch of the skin can break the skin and introduce rabies into our system. And so if that happens, if you're a parent and your child has had an interaction, throw on a heavy pair of leather gloves, gardening gloves, throw it in a sack, put it in the fridge, not the freezer, don't freeze them, but put it in the fridge, call the health department at 435-333-1500, and we will get you squared away and taken care of so we know what's going on.
Okay, and so when you talk about testing the brain, that's where it's centered?
Yeah, that's where they look for that positive sample. They will remove the brain at the state lab. They will dye it with special chemicals and then put it under UV light and look for the presence of rabies inside the brain.
Hmm. Okay, it's also, 'tis the season for the harmful algal bloom season. So what causes these?
There's a number of environmental factors. There's also some structural and infrastructure factors as well. Our system in the state of Utah and the way that we transfer water out of the mountains and into municipal areas is set up in a way that we draw the cold water off the bottom through the dam and let water out. You mix that with an increase in the outside temperature because it's summertime, and the water temperature starts to increase with the nutrients and that are introduced into the water with runoff and a variety of other things, we start to see a prime habitat for cyanobacteria to start proliferating and creating a harmful algal bloom. Now, this isn't new. If you talk to some of the old timers here in Summit County that have been fishing Echo and Rockport, they'll tell you this has been happening for 50 years. And I would agree with them. That is the case. This is a natural cycle that occurs. What we know now is how harmful algal blooms and cyanobacteria can be to humans and pets. It is really tough when dogs drink water that's infested with or impacted by a harmful algal bloom. It attacks their central nervous system almost immediately and can result in death of that animal. So this is not so much to say that humans are really at risk of death from a harmful algal bloom, but it does create discomfort. It can create rashes and that on the skin. But your pets are really at risk in a harmful algal bloom. So, you know, this is one of those things that when you look at the water, if it doesn't look like healthy water to swim in, generally avoid it. And report it. We'd love to hear from you. There's ways to report that through the state on a website. We have it under our resources tab on the Summit County Health Department website. You can call us and report it. But really, right now we have three locations in our area, Jordanelle, Rockport, and Echo, that we continue to sample this time of year. We anticipate and expect that at some point, some of those isolated bays that don't see the wind will show up with a harmful algal bloom. And we encourage the public to be aware and vigilant that when you're out there swimming, boating, fishing, that you're keeping an eye on that. And in the event that you see a harmful algal bloom, avoid it and move to a different part of the lake.
Okay. So if the water's clear, you're okay?
Generally speaking, yeah, up to about 6 inches below the surface, you can see some of those traditional indicators that it might be a harmful algal bloom. It looks like somebody spilled paint or antifreeze on the top of the water. It's got a really vibrant fluorescent green color to it, floating mats. Sometimes there's little, like you could describe as fuzz balls, floating subsurface that could also be type of a harmful algal bloom. So if you look at that water and it doesn't have that really bright blue summertime water that you would expect to jump into and cool off during these hot days, just avoid it, report it, let us go out and do our thing and determine what's going on there.
Yeah, so is it, you talked about runoff. Is it as a result of fertilizers and stuff that we're putting?
Yeah, it's a variety of surface fertilizers, nutrients in the soil, animal waste. You know, we're adding nitrates and other nutrients to the water that the bacteria really just thrive on. And when you see that water warm up and it goes from that cooler cycle that we see during the winter and it reaches that temperature that it thrives, we should anticipate that these type of things are going to pop up.
Okay. And you had mentioned there is a place you can go online to see if a water body does have a harmful bloom.
Yeah, we will have that on our website later today, but you can do a simple Google search of harmful algal blooms in Utah, and it will pop up a interactive map that is color-coded based on the body of water, and it will indicate whether it's suspect, under investigation, caution, or extreme danger. And you can educate yourself before you go out, and that does not mean that the entire body of water is under those conditions. It just means that at the point where they sampled or where a report was given, that was the status of that point in time where a harmful algal bloom may or may not have been present. So be aware, do your research, call the health department if you need help or an explanation on what's happening in that body of water, and we're happy to work with you.
So is that something that we saw there at the reflecting pool there at the National Mall? Was that an algal bloom?
Yeah, it's an algal bloom of some sort. You know, it's the same thing that you see in a swimming pool that goes unmaintained or a type of fountain like that. I don't know if that was actually cyanobacteria, but mostly algal blooms happen. They turn the water green, and it's an indication that the water's not healthy and we need to avoid it.
Okay. Hey, I wanted to mention, because earlier this year we had talked about the number of men struggling with mental health issues and you know, just tend not to share, kind of keep it to themselves, and may not get the help that they need. But what we didn't talk about was maybe the resources that the county can provide if somebody is struggling.
Yeah, you know, I was really impressed with the traction that our conversation last month around suicide and men's mental health received in the community. I know it was well discussed throughout the month of June, and I'm really excited about that we're starting to have these conversations as part of just being human and understanding that it's okay to not be okay, but it's never okay to hurt yourself or someone else. And as you mentioned, Leslie, we have resources available here in the community. The first resource, as always, whether you are an individual experiencing a mental health crisis or you're a family member or a loved one of someone going through this, if you can't remember this conversation that we're having today, call 911. Our dispatch center, our first responders here in Summit County are trained on the initial response to a 911 mental health crisis. And if you don't remember anything else today, it is okay to call 911 in that situation. If you do remember to call 988, that's actually the preferred way to do it. Those are licensed clinical professionals on the back end of that call that stand ready and willing to talk to you, whether it's you or a loved one, on how to handle this situation. It doesn't immediately trigger anything until it becomes a real emergent situation. But in the event that it does, we can get our mobile crisis outreach team out there, first responders. But 988 has resources to help people talk through situations and then get them the resources they need with follow-up visits with licensed professionals. In the event that you just want to be prepared, we have the Safe UT app, which is a free confidential crisis chat and tip line that connects you to a licensed mental health professional. Now, this app can be downloaded on the Google App Store or the Apple App Store. It's 100% free. It comes in English and in Spanish. It is catered to students, parents, and guardians. They have one for frontline and healthcare workers, and then they have one for National Guard members. And when we talk about the parents and the children, they have two separate apps. If you are under 18 and you want a safe space to talk to a mental health professional, you can do that. If you're a parent and you're trying to work with a child who is struggling through some mental health concerns, that app is a great resource for you. So those are three really good places to start. Now, if you're experiencing a mental health crisis and you need help, you can call our health department, 435-333-1500, and we can put you in touch with our behavioral health team. And then from there, they can help you find some of those resources that we have available through our contract with the University of Utah to provide services here in town. We don't want people to feel as though they have to fight this battle alone, that they are isolated. Because the county council, the board of health, our behavioral health team, and Aaron Newman have gone to extensive lengths to make these resources as available as possible. Now, we understand there's probably gaps and we're not capturing everybody, but if you know someone who's struggling with this, you can even call me and I will get you connected to the right people, because we don't want someone to go through the loss and the hurt of a loved one and suicide.
Okay. Finally, wanted to mention you've got some seniors farmers markets coming up in Colville and Camas, huh?
Yeah, Colville and Camas. Colville on Wednesday, Camas on Thursday. Really, this has been a wildly successful program, and I do want to give kudos to where it's deserved. And Tabitha, one of our health education specialists, has done a wonderful job in getting this going. And in fact, it is completely booked out. Year two, it's booked out. And we would encourage individuals that are 55 plus to reach out to get on the wait list, because what that does is provide us with data points to understand how we can grow this program in coming years. We want to make sure that it's available to all seniors who qualify, and with kind of a slow ramp up and start to test the waters, to dip our toes, we have seen immense success and we want to continue this program.
So what is it exactly?
What happens is, through a grant that we have with the state and some local partners, seniors that are part of the program receive $50 towards fresh fruit and vegetables. In those locations where the farmers market is held in Colville and Camas, they can go on the day of the market and with their vouchers work with staff to grab fresh fruits and veggies. It's not something that is open to the public. This is catered to our seniors. We want our seniors to know that we're thinking of them as well, and that we want them to be healthy and partake in the good food of the season. And so working with our partners, we have the opportunity to expand this program in the future and make it available to all seniors. We're really excited about it.
Okay, that's awesome. All right, Phil, we'll talk to you next month. Thanks. Hey,
thank you.
In the studio now, I have Summit County Sheriff Casey Bates, along with her Chief Deputy John Evans. Good morning to both of you. Thank you.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, thanks for having us.
Casey, let's just start with the 4th of July. Did you have any violations reported, any citations issued? Even though they were outlawed, there were still some sounds of fireworks going off.
Yes, there were still some sounds, but Leslie, this was, I believe, a very successful 4th of July. If you look at our past 4th of Julys, and this one was very successful. We had nearly 100% compliance over the 4th of July weekend. We did hear some, but when I came into the office after the 4th of July weekend, I had our communications director look up a day before and a day after, and we only received 3 calls of people calling in fireworks violations. I think some of the things that helped that were putting out the information. We had billboards put out. Our emergency manager contacted Public Works. We put them at all of the locations of people coming in. I think a huge help was our municipalities. We're on board. I think that was magnificent. And I appreciate that. And I just want to thank the residents, and I want to thank our municipalities for knowing the importance of this. We're in a really bad place with fire danger, and it's not worth it. We can see in the south the huge fire that's out there. All of our resources are out there helping them. And I just think it's important. Even though I love fireworks as much as the next person, the importance of the fire danger and being responsible, I can't say it enough. And I believe that as we continue to Pioneer Day, that these the restrictions are going to stay. And we would really appreciate if people would continue the no fireworks. It's going to be the I hope the municipalities are on board with the fire restrictions and the fireworks restrictions.
Okay. Residents realize the severity of the situation.
Yeah. And I think another thing, if people have questions, you can go to utahfireinfo.org for any information about the current conditions. I mean, we all can see with the heat that we're seeing right now that those conditions are probably not going to change. But we just would appreciate everybody being responsible.
Okay. John, one of the programs that the Summit County Jail offers is a gardening program. Are you still offering that to jailers?
Yes. Our inmates run the garden program for us. It's a program that was started around 8 years ago, and with the sheriff's direction, we continue to move forward with it. And it's we grow pumpkins. We grow we donate those pumpkins to county employees.
Nonprofits,
and the sheriff loves to go around when we do that, and she hands them out to the people that receive them. It's a very good, very positive program.
So is it something that an inmate would sign up for?
We do have jobs, and it is considered a job in the jail, and there is a list of inmates that want to go out there. We're limited to 2 inmates out there, and so there's a waiting list, but as people leave the jail and move on with their lives, more people come forward and they operate the greenhouse.
Yeah. Oh, so everything's in a greenhouse?
It's a greenhouse and a garden, so inside and outside. So
okay.
It's behind the sheriff's office.
Yeah, what else do you grow?
They grow vegetables for the kitchen. They grow flowers, sunflowers. I think that's about all they grow, Sheriff, right?
Yeah, so one of the things to really point out is that this garden started out as a very small-scale garden. And while the inmates are the ones that have grown it, because they're the ones that are out there all the time. They go out there in the morning. They take pride in what they do. And so they actually helped build the greenhouse. That wasn't there before. They helped build the greenhouse. They've made different levels in our garden. So we have this huge pumpkin patch, and then we have squash, and we have zucchinis and these huge sunflowers, and they take the seeds from the sunflowers at the end of the year and keep them so that you can plant them the next year. And we have people come in to teach them how to grow and when to grow. And so what we have done is just scaled this up, and now they go out even earlier, and we have covers for the pumpkins because we all know that we get the last freeze that we all have to cover for. So we have people come in and educate from the health department. We have people who have donated seeds. We have people who donate the soil that, you know, to help it and fertilize. And so we have a really great community that supports this, because funding, you don't always get funding for these things. So our community support is really important. And if anybody has seen it, we'll have to take pictures and put it on our social media posts, because it really looks incredible. I was out there the other day, and it's really looking good. And they take pride in it. That's the other thing. Whenever I go out there and I'm walking back in the jail, they say, "Sheriff, come and look at this. Look how big this pumpkin is." And last year we had close to 500 pumpkins that were grown in our garden.
And to continue with that, the inmates that are leaving that work in the garden are very selective on who they want to come out and take over for them. And they have everything written down. They have have very strict rules for themselves, and it's part of the pride they take in it. It's incredible to see.
Yeah. So we had heard during the Corey Richens trial about how she kept herself very busy while she spent years there at the jail. So what else do you offer? Because, you know, garden is a summertime program.
Yeah, so we have one of the best programmings in the state for the county jails. We have yoga classes. We have resume classes that they can a volunteer comes in and teaches them how to write a resume, so when they leave, they can have a leg up on getting a job. We have GED classes, so they can get their high school degree before they leave. We have an art class. I got a local artist comes in a couple times a week, and he teach them how to draw or how to do some artwork, different variations. And we also have, what else do we have, Sheriff, back there?
Well, we have all the regular programming, but we just have more of some really unique stuff. We have our AA, we have our NA, we have,
we recently started an IOP program, an outpatient program. Intensive outpatient program to help with their addiction. So we have an outside clap people that come in from Heber City, and they teach an IOP, and it's a 6-month, very intensive program. And for the state inmates that are with us, they get a time cut for completing that, and it gives them a leg up once again when they leave, that they can control that addiction as they exit the system.
Yeah. And additionally, there are like jobs there at the jail where people can make not much money, but some money?
Yes, of course. Some places, they do it for free. We compensate at a small amount. We compensate our incarcerated persons for doing the work that they're doing. We also have a kitchen program. As the chief mentioned, we have a Meals on Wheels program. We have our laundry program. Everything that we have is to hopefully give them the skills and give them something that they can put on their resume, so that when they go to the resume, the person that helps them with their resume, that they can build that resume, and then it reduces recidivism. It keeps them from coming back and gives them the purpose.
Part of the corrections division is to help correct the behavior, so when they get out, they don't come back. And we do everything possible on our end with the sheriff's office to help reduce that rate of them coming back.
Yeah, so you offer this to people who have jail terms of what, longer than a month or something?
You just have to be sentenced. You have to be sentenced, and you have to be without violations or without any
bad behavior write-ups.
Is what they call them. But yeah, behavior write-ups. And so as long as you don't have either of these, you have to be sentenced, then you are put into a pool of people that can work.
All right. Let's see. The new e-bike laws have gone into effect. Are you having challenges with that? I mean, are you enforcing the laws which require riders to be of a certain age and to ride certain bikes and to have a helmet on if they're under a certain age?
So it's House Bill 381, went into effect on May 6th. As we've seen, there's a lot of changes in e-bikes and motorcycles and the classifications and what goes along with that. what I believe and what I have told the deputies is I think that education is the most important thing right now. We need to educate. I believe that any parent or person that's going to go buy an e-bike or a motorcycle needs to know the laws. Educate yourself on the laws. If you have a child that is asking for an e-bike, please educate yourself on what that child can ride legally. As I don't know if a lot of people know, under the law, if you're under 16, you can't operate a class 3 e-bike. Know what a class 3 is. Educate yourself. If you're under 14, you have to be supervised by a parent. If you're under 8, you can't even operate one at all. So I think education is key right now. There's a lot of new laws. There's a lot of new information coming out, and that's what's important. But we have had a couple instances where we've had repeat people, and we've had to take their bike from them. One of the changes in the law that happened was that we used to have to impound them. And one of the changes is we can hold that bike instead of impounding it and require the parent to come and get it. And I'm hoping that with that, the parents can come and get the bike, we can educate them, and I hope they bring the child as well and say, these are the rules and regulations that go with this. We are spending a lot of time educating. At the end of the year, we had at Ecker Hill, we had a huge educational experience there. When school gets back in, it's our goal that we have a lot of educational moments that because they ride their bikes there. And we can't really get people in the summer because everybody's on vacation and going places. So the time to do that is when we're back in school and we have after school moments or like educational opportunities that we can get parents and kids together to learn the laws. And that's what I think is the most important. If parents want information, you can go to, you can either type in Utah State House Bill 381. It's a really long bill. It doesn't only have e-bike regulations. It has other stuff, but it's there. And I really would like people to educate themselves on this.
Okay. And when you talk about that you're no longer impounding, just holding it, impound would cost you a bunch of money.
So that was one of the things of change that was helpful, because with impounding, state tax impound comes fines, comes fees, and it's really expensive. We still can impound. We just have the option that now we can hold it and require parents to come and get that bike, which I believe was helpful because I think the education is key. A lot of parents buy these bikes for these kids and they don't know. And that's, you know, I think the educational, that's where education comes in, and I think it's important.
Okay. Finally, I wanted to ask you about the Citizens Academy. This is coming up. Are you still accepting applications?
We aren't, because we're full. We had our applications open for about 1 week, and within 24 hours, our class was full. And so we continue to have more and more interest each year on our Citizens Academy. Sergeant Talbot does an incredible job with our Citizens Academy, which is why we have such a huge interest in it. If anyone's interested in being on the interest list for next year, that would be, if you could just put an email to stalbot@summitcountyutah.org. He will add you to the interest list for next year. We're going to be going August through October of this year, and we're really looking forward to it.
Okay. You do just one a year?
We just do one a year. Yes. We're looking to do two a year because of all of the interest. And I think I said the email wrong. It's stalbot@summitcountyutah.gov. I apologize.
Okay. Got it. Sheriff Casey Bates and Chief Deputy John Evans, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks,
Thank
Leslie.
You,
Park City Opera will produce Aaron Copland's The Tenderland with a chamber orchestra this weekend, and in the studio with details, I have the executive director and one of the performers of Park City Opera, Lena Goldman, along with Rachel Kobernick. Good morning, ladies. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Lena, both of you are performing in the role of Laurie. We'll talk a little bit about that. Rachel will be on Saturday, you on Sunday. But maybe start just by telling us a little bit about Park City Opera, your mission, and how Summit County can support an opera company.
That's a great question. Park City Opera is in our third season now, so we founded in 2024. And this summer, we have expanded our offerings, and we're producing not one, but two main stage operas. And so this coming weekend, we have performances of The Tenderland, which, of course, is an American opera. And then later in August, we'll be at the Echo Center at the high school for the first time, producing Romeo and Juliet, a French opera.
Okay. And again, so you're seeing good turnouts then for the performances.
We are. In fact, we've got 25 performances all over town this summer and in the surrounding communities, many of which are free to attend and totally open to the public. And what we're finding is that by putting opera in City Park, for example, or at the Park City Library or in galleries on Main Street, people are finding us and are discovering something in this art form that maybe they didn't know about before. Maybe they had an assumption that opera perhaps wasn't for them because they haven't spent their whole lives attending. And by being in this community's backyard and being very vocal and present all around town, we're seeing folks that discover us perhaps in a free setting and then really want to return to see the full productions, which of course offer something totally different in terms of experience because we have the components of orchestra and costumes and sets and lighting and singers from all over the country and for the first time the world. And so then they purchase tickets to these main stage operas.
Okay, so The Tenderland isn't a kind of a traditional opera. I'm guessing it's in English. It's a relatively new opera and it's actually Aaron Copland's only full length opera. So is it a traditional opera in the sense that you have four voices telling a story?
It's actually rather similar to some of the more traditional operas that we're used to in terms of having an orchestra and a rather large cast and multiple acts, but you're totally right. It being in English is a singular experience for some new opera goers in that it's very accessible. We will have super titles, so you're able to read the text along with the singers, but there isn't that element of translation, so that definitely makes it unique and a less barrier to communicate with our audiences. But in other ways, I think it's very reminiscent of a traditional opera with amazing music and a great plot and drama and a lot of pathos. So,
okay. So for those, Rachel, who may not be familiar with The Tenderland, can you tell us a little bit about the story and why you think it resonates with audiences today?
Sure. It's about a young girl named Lori who's on the eve of her graduation from high school. And she lives in a somewhat conservative country town. And her family is unwilling to kind of let her bloom in the way that she wishes to go out and see the world. And so she faces a lot of constraints in that way. And she's very adventurous and she's excited to see what lies ahead. And two drifters come along through town and she ends up falling in love with one of them and wishes to kind of go off with him. And so she finds some conflict with her family and in that new relationship. And so there's that whole element of plot, and then there's a lot of just love of beauty of nature and country. And so it's really appropriate for America's 250th as far as sound world. And it's also amazing to do it in such a beautiful place like Park City because we get to really experience the nature as we bring these characters to life. So that has been really awesome.
Yeah, so how is this opera different than what, you know, we might see on a Broadway musical?
That's a great question. It's the style of singing, for one. So obviously, the sound that you'll experience is more classical in nature. Although when Copland wrote this opera, the critical reception of it was that it's written in plain English. It's very understandable. The pattern of the language is just akin to how we would speak, which is really special, even by American opera standards. And then, of course, the primary difference is that opera singers sing without microphones. And so we are trained to use the resonating chambers in our body to produce sound that can carry over hundreds of people and an orchestra of dozens of players, rather than use amplification, which of course allows for other effects and is a wonderful thing in certain genres like musical theater. But I would say that's the primary difference in the type of experience that you have when you attend the opera. And particularly in this production of The Tenderland, which is going up at Temple Har Shalom, the audiences will be just a few feet away from the orchestra and from the singers. And so you have a very unique experience by way of opera, because typically when we go to a large opera house, we're, you know, dozens or hundreds of feet away from the singers. And so you really we hope that you really experience the power of the natural resonance of these voices up close and personal.
Yeah. You'd mentioned Temple Har Shalom. So the opera will be produced when and where, and how much are tickets?
Yes. So the opera will be produced on Saturday and Sunday, July 18th and 19th, both evenings at 5 p.m. at Temple Har Shalom. And we're utilizing this sort of indoor-outdoor nature of this venue to really speak to the plot and setting of the opera. Tickets start at $75 and are available for both evenings. And within the price of a ticket, you get a full experience. So all week I've been saying you should come for the opera, but stay for the party, because at 4 p.m. the doors will open and there are complimentary American bites by Chef Galen Zamara, who will be catering the event. We'll have a cash bar in partnership with Top Shelf Utah and Alpine Distilling. We'll even have pre-show folk music by Kate McLeod, playing the fiddle and the dulcimer and acoustic guitar, and plein air painting. So we'll have an artist painting the scenery live. And so all of these elements are meant to speak to the actual plot of the opera and to the American sound world that we're celebrating this July.
And as I mentioned, you will both be singing the role of Lori. Why was the decision made to split it like that?
Sometimes when an opera is produced and there's a large lead character, it's really wonderful to be able to have two different perspectives come at the same role. And so it's been an amazing experience. Lena and I actually knew each other from a couple of years ago when we did a program in Italy. And so it's amazing to be able to collaborate with your colleagues in that way many years later even. And so I think we each bring something really unique to the role, and our castmates get to kind of experience a run of the show in two different ways. And there's so much to explore within an opera and a plot. And so I think it also at the same time kind of lightens the load of a performance. And that's why companies frequently will have two separate casts for various things. But less so than the workload. It's more of an amazing collaboration and a tag teaming of sorts. Mm-hmm. So come see both.
Yeah. And I'm guessing it's a little bit easier to learn because it's in English.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. A lot of times when we start an opera, we spend a couple weeks or months translating the full text so we really know what we're saying. And this was, you can immediately dive into the character and your interpretation because we, of course, already speak the language and in that way can really communicate our dramatic intention with the audience.
Yeah. So, Lena, I mean, you wear several hats with Park City Opera, co-founder, artistic director, performer, executive director. I mean, I guess how do you balance that and do a production like this?
I have an amazing team of co-founders, so I'll shout out my artistic director co-founder, Benjamin Beckman, as well as our operations director and development director, Liesl Vangerman. And the three of us are really the ones curating the experience for this summer, 110 artists from across the state, the country, and the globe who will be visiting Park City to lend their time and talent to Park City Opera. And so we have so many amazing community partnerships that allow us to make this happen. I'll highlight just a few, but every Monday in City Park, in partnership with Mountain Town Music, we're producing free concerts. Our production of Romeo and Juliet this August would not be possible without the support of Ballet West, who will be lending the talents of a dozen of their dancers and their choreographer to be on stage and bring professional ballet to Romeo and Juliet, and the list goes on. So I have amazing co-founders. I have an amazing community of artists who have auditioned from all over and who are spending time here with us this summer. And then there is just a really robust network of nonprofits, community organizations, and local businesses who support what we do.
Great. Okay, again, where can people get tickets and learn more about your summer season?
We do hope that you'll join us. Tickets and information about all of our shows, including The Tenderland, are found at www.parkcityopera.org.
Okay, well, good luck, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Again, Park City Opera's Lena Goldman and Rachel Koberneck. They'll be performing this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 18th and 19th at 5 p.m. at Temple Har Shalom.